Bella San.
You saw her?
She gave me air.
I knew she was real.
We talked. I don't know exactly how, but we did.
Telepathy.
Yeah. She thinks of someone. Someone named Christopher. Some sailor who ships...
Welcome to Fearful Symmetry.
Okay, let's return to Rowena. Rowena Markaj, the woman of the woods. Because there's a story that I neglected to mention last time, and I think it's important. And besides, it's pretty much the only sex in this whole narrative. Now, by this time, you've heard of a certain pilgrimage Rowena made to the ancient waters of Lake Ohrid, where a strange tribe of legendary snails are said to sing from the deepest depths of the lake. And you've heard, too, of the enchanted life that Rowena and filmmaker Saimir Kambaro enjoyed in the magical woods of Albania. But I've already said that a lot of that came out of Kambaro's book, and that, you know, the maestro was probably not the world's most reliable source. So while he was quite fond of saying that Rowena inspired him to conceive his greatest ideas, to make his greatest works, it turns out that the couple's old servant, Koblesh Konegi, said something rather different. She was the first to insist, years later in a newspaper article, that it was Rowena who conceived, designed, and dictated what later became known as Hatchet Man. And this she knew for a certainty because, while she did not wish to be indiscreet, she had occasion to witness many intimate transactions between the two. Koblesh Konegi claims that the couple engaged in a most prolific and peculiar manner of lovemaking. Each morning, after strong black tea, the two would disrobe and Rowena would mount her husband atop the wooden kitchen table, scattering milk saucers and little plates of jam and butter. Once enjoined, she would lean down and begin to whisper the tale of each episode into his ear. She would carefully time their lovemaking so that the story's climax would come simultaneously with their own. Afterwards, Kambaro would rush to his notebook and write down everything he could remember. Now, maybe you find all this far-fetched, whispering each episode into his ear while they were having sex. What is this? A fairy tale? Something from Thousand and One Nights? I can only tell you that Koblesh Konegi swears on it, and she was, after all, the poor woman who had to clean up the mess every morning. In any case, none of this explains how or why an incredibly demented TV show, one that always ended in slaughter, could actually take over a nation and lead to mass chaos. That's what we have to look at now. How did everything get so crazy so quickly? You have to imagine just how bewildered a typical Albanian might have found the Hatchet Man show. It was a cosmic what the fuck? Like, what did it mean? Is this what TV in the modern world looks like? Is there some kind of moral statement about life here? What are people supposed to feel? There was no context, no clarification, no answers of any kind. The creators of the show, real or imagined, remained silent. And it's that beguiling mystery which proved the undoing of the masses. Their grim lives had always been bound by clear parameters of good and evil, permission and restriction. So the irrationality of the show led to endless speculation. Speculation that intensified with each episode. And pretty soon, you know, that shit just led to religion. Here's what happened. The night of the weekly Hatchet Man broadcast became known as the Night of the Hatchet. And so it was that at 8 p.m. every Tuesday evening in the fall of 1996, you could stroll through the streets of any town in Albania and never see another human soul. They were all inside, young and old, loners, lovers, crowded families, all in their little rooms with their old televisions, all taking part in this electronic communion. And when the episode was over, an exodus outside, where even strangers would share reactions to the latest grisly events and the giddy sensations of how it felt when Hatchet Man made his long-awaited arrival and executed his will. I've already mentioned the three-story monument with the mass figure wielding the huge gleaming hatchet, but it's important that you understand that the crowds that flocked to the monument grew with each episode, and I'm not sure if the people could explain why they were drawn there. In the daytime, it was simply a new place to hang out, drink tea, smoke, and gossip with friends. But there were those who seemed overly preoccupied by Hatchet Man, and at night, it started to get a little weird. People started coming with torches. Some of the old ones found this distressing. It carried the pungent whiff of the Nazis. They still remembered the occupiers from 50 years earlier. But young folk, they were into it. So they had their torches, lots of them, and they would have these mass chants, Naomi Hatchet, Naomi Hatchet, Naomi Hatchet, we are the Hatchet. Cops gathered, later military troops, just in case, though even some of them would join in the chanting. And it wasn't just these night rallies. All through the country, there were dozens, perhaps hundreds, of small, improvised shrines to Hatchet Man. Most of these shrines would be marked by the sign of a hatchet, painted on a wall or a tree. Around it, you would find candles, acorns, red wine, rusty knives, seaweed, chicken beaks, light bulbs, oven mitts, blurry photographs of waterfalls, and assorted hymns and testimonials to the power of Hatchet Man. For yes, some began to see Hatchet Man as a divine figure, an omnipotent force, unknowable but all-knowing, mysterious but always near. At that time, one might stumble across small groups assembling at these very shrines, taking part in a ritual that they came to call recitum, or recitation. It would go like this. One individual would don a ski mask and recount, with great care and concentration, the entire story of a previous episode, scene by scene, in perfect sequence. And then at prescribed intervals in the blessed narrative, the speaker would pause and nod to the others who responded as a kind of chorus, chanting, gladness and grief, fear not, the Hatchet Man knows, and he will surely come, and he will surely come. And then the story of the episode would resume and continue this way until recitum was finished. And if this call and response sounds super freaky, like something from a B-movie about an apocalyptic cult, well, yeah. Yeah, it was a cult, and they were kind of freaks. They were hopelessly immersed in the figure of the Hatchet Man. They called themselves little hatchets, waiting only to be wielded by a divine force. Now, for most Albanians, it was a different story. The show was an obsession, yes, maybe an extreme obsession, but it was also an obsessive diversion, an escape from problems, just fun. Waiting for the grisly violence and the emotional release, covering their eyes but looking between their fingers as Hatchet Man would gut the nurse in the new hospital or chop off the feet of an inspiring gym teacher. It was all fake terror, giggles, and catharsis. But even these people, who on the surface were so different from the cult of the little hatchets, even these people ended up taking the abrupt end of the series in a most alarming way. Because there's another story here, a bigger story, with roots that lay deep in Albania's totalitarian history. That's a story of political calamity and economic disaster that began before Hatchet Man was ever dreamt of. And the dark forces of that story had no small role in the social upheaval, murder, and civil war that was to come. And there's no fairy tale with any of that. Hatchet Man Show was never political. It featured simple characters, familiar settings, odd little tales, and then, of course, the great Munster in the ski mask who resolves all issues. But there was something different about Episode 7. Not for me or you, of course. For an outsider, all these episodes were straight-up Looney Tunes, just wildly and beautifully absurd. But if you were Albanian, well, the seventh episode seemed to address the unaddressable, the specter of the great daddy of Albania's dark and not-so-distant past. The episode begins with a young fisherman, Besnik, who finds in the sand a tiny wooden figure of a mermaid. In Albanian tribal folklore, this legendary water nymph goes by the name of Milisan. Besnik gives a quiet thanks to the heavens and stuffs the object in his pocket. The show then cuts to a small, rather tawdry neighborhood beauty salon, its walls covered with faded advertisements for beauty creams and ripped out magazine pictures of Italian actresses. There's a couple of chairs, and in one of them sits a middle-aged woman in curlers extending her right arm as a young beautician, Luetta, applies a blood-red polish to her nails. We're brought into the middle of their conversation, and the woman is gossiping about how her husband is a liar and a drunk, and her neighbor buys fancy shoes while the children go hungry, and pretty much how everyone in town is awful. And Luetta is just sweet and sincere, and she says things like, "Oh my," and "May God protect the little ones." And then Besnik enters the shop. We immediately see he's Luetta's boyfriend because she just lights up to see him. He hands her the little mermaid that he found, which he had attached to a simple string, and she adores it. Says that as a little girl, she always felt a deep connection to Milisan. She puts the figure around her neck, promising that she will keep this gift by her heart forever. Now, at this point, the show moves to an odd but amusing scene about a lonely prison guard with irritable bowels and a secret collection of Croatian bottle caps. But for what I need to tell you, I'm going to skip that plot line and fast forward to our young lovers again. They're walking along a street chatting. Behind them, what looks like a smelting plant is spewing sickly green plumes into the sky. The camera cuts closer and we see that Luetta seems forlorn. She's talking about her little sister who needs a wooden arm after tragically losing her limb in a wheat thrasher mishap. But the prosthetic is so expensive, her family has no savings, especially since they lost their beet field to last year's locust infestation. Where will she ever get the money? She begins to weep. They slowly walk around the corner, and now they're somehow in a totally different environment. The show was never great about visual continuity, and they're standing along a beach, and Besnik assures her it will all work out somehow. And Luetta, touching her necklace, says, "If only the blessed mermaid could help." And she gazes out at the brilliant blue lake or red and tells Besnik, "Life is difficult, my darling, but at least our lake is beautiful." And he tries to cheer her up and says, "And I've heard it is wet too." And he runs right into the water and starts swimming. And she laughs and claps her hand in approval as he swims further and further out. And then she happens to notice something out of the corner of her eye, something curious on the ground amid the sand. What is that? She bends down and lifts up what appears to be a human eyeball. "How strange," she says. Perplexed, she looks around and spies another one, and then another. She sees eyeballs all along the beach. What could this possibly mean? She must tell Besnik. He will know. But when she looks back at the immense lake, she's immediately buffeted by a terrific gust of wind. A storm has seemingly come out of nowhere. The winds are now all whipped up and wild waves are crashing on the lake shore, and she doesn't see Beznik anywhere. She calls out, "Beznik! Beznik, my sweet!" No answer. She calls out again, louder over the wind, "Beznik! Beznik!" No response. She has no idea where he is. This stretch of the beach is empty, and she can't see a single soul out on the roiling lake. She starts running, one way, then another. She's desperately shouting out his name, "Beznik!" Finally, she just falls to her knees on the beach. "He's drowned. He's drowned," she says. Then she clutches the tiny mermaid around her neck and prays, "Oh, please, please, Melisan, please bring him back to me. Bring him back. Bring him back." And then just like that, the wind subsides, and the figure of Beznik, like a miracle, emerges from the waters a mere 50 meters away. He stumbles toward her, exhausted but elated. They embrace. She says, "I thought you drowned." And he says, "Melisan, I saw Melisan." And she says, "You saw her?" And he says, "I was drowning and she gave me air." And she says, "I knew she was real." And he says, "We talked. I don't exactly know how, but we did." And she says, "Telepathy." I'm reading each line here with my powerful gift for dialect because I think it's only proper to point out that this particular scene was lifted almost word for word from a season 7 episode of Baywatch. In that episode, a mysterious mermaid is infatuated with a hunky lifeguard, not David Hasselhoff, one of the other hunky lifeguards on the show. And this hunky lifeguard is telling his girlfriend all about the mermaid, the girlfriend being played by noted thespian Pamela Anderson, also in the role of a lifeguard. But in our Hatchet Man version, there's no love triangle, and really the two episodes are utterly different, save for this one scene. Why did the Hatchet Man writers put the scene there? God knows. As I mentioned at the very top of this tale, Baywatch was syndicated all over the world during the 1990s, including Albania. Now, maybe the Albanian audience recognized the adaptation, appreciated it. Again, no idea. But okay, let's recap. Lujeta sees eyeballs on the beach. Beznik vanishes in the ancient lake. Lujeta beseeches Melisan for help. Beznik crawls out of the water saying he was saved by Melisan. He says they talked. Lujeta says it must be telepathy. And here's where the story continues. Beznik says, "Yes, that must be it. She thinks I'm someone named Christo, some sailor whose ship sank in a storm 100 years ago. And Lujeta just kind of swoons and says, "Oh, that's so romantic." And then they proceed to have a pretty heavy kiss, at least for Albanian standards. And it goes on for a bit. And while it goes on, there's some kind of electronic interference with the sound and the image. A murmur, a fluctuating static that's growing in intensity. And the image of the couple begins to bend and blur, the perspective shifting until we're viewing the kiss through a circular frame, a kind of gauzy peephole. At which point, there's a bizarre cut revealing that we've been watching from the point of view of an old man in a wheelchair, peering through an extremely large telescope. The old man is dressed in a gray suit and tie, and he's wearing these jumbo headphones. He seems to be located in a tower of some kind with huge windows all around, each mounted with a mighty telescope aimed in a different direction. And each telescope is attached through long green cables to a huge vibrating eyeball, the size of a washing machine, standing in the center of the room. I mean, it's a lot to take in. The whole set is something out of an old Flash Gordon film serial from the 1930s, a kind of comic book vision of the future. In this case, some kind of nerve center for mass surveillance. The huge vibrating eyeball looks totally ridiculous, but it's kind of great too, right? And then we start to hear salsa music. It grows louder, and suddenly a shirtless young man in red underwear bursts through the door, dancing on roller skates, a boombox in one hand and a coffee mug in the other. And he sings, "It's time for Coco, Uncle Panapop." The old man furiously turns toward him. "Imbecile, I am working." He points a threatening finger at the young man. "I will cut your spleen out with an old razor blade." The young man falls to his knees, quaking with fear and sobbing. "I'm sorry, Commander. Please, please don't kill me. My virtuous mother depends on my wheat rations." The old man sighs. He eyes the long, supple limbs of the young man on the floor. His voice softens and he says, "All right, all right. Come over here, my little ducky duck, and rub my legs." Now, if you're Albanian in 1996, this scene may have blown your mind, because you're immediately thinking, is that supposed to be Uncle Enver? The late Uncle Enver, otherwise known as Enver Hoxha, the insane dictator who ruled Albania for 40 years with an iron fist, killing anyone and everyone he pleased. Even as an old man bound to a wheelchair, Hoxha exerted absolute control over the Albanian nation. A sour look from the great leader can make a strong man piss his pants. But that was the past. The son of a bitch was dead more than a decade before. So for the specter of Uncle Enver to arise in the sacred realm of the beloved Hatchet Man show, people knew some deep, heavy shit was underway.
Historia zic të deshi, komandant dhe komisar.
You've been listening to part 3 of Hatchet Man, a production of Fearful Symmetry, written, performed, and produced by Bob Paris. Music and sound art from Voyagers, The Shed, Turku, John Bartman, Keith Jars, MFP, Group D Bensa, and Salakapaka Sound System. For more information, please go to fearfulsymmetry.org